You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been hard to read a newspaper recently without finding another rave review for Sam Lipsyte's new collection of short stories, The Fun Parts. It's the follow-up to his novel, The Ask, which he published 2 years ago. And this series of dark, manic, hilarious tales merge, as Publishers Weekly put it, warmth and pathos as he tangles with the thorny human experiences of moving beyond one's past, of shedding one's personal baggage. The Fun Part has just been published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux, and I'm delighted that it brings Sam Lipsyte back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
It's not bad for a writer whose characters many people call losers. Would you characterize them that way?
I usually don't think of them that way when I'm writing. I just think of them as people who are struggling with both their own self-delusions and also the problems of just being a human being right now.
Well, the protagonist of your 2004 novel, Homeland, says at one point, "I did not pan out."
Right.
And that could be said for a number of these characters.
Yeah, there's a panning out problem with a lot of my characters.
Now, that novel had nothing in common with the Showtime series, but it did come out around right after 9/11. Did you give it the name Homeland because of that phrase was in the public eye?
I did. I suddenly was hearing a phrase that I hadn't heard for a long time, or maybe ever.
It sounded German to a lot of people.
Yeah, it sounded like fatherland. It sounded suddenly very militaristic and strange to my ears and the ears of others. And what I did is I split the words up. So there's a space between home and land that I hope was a place that the readers could settle.
Do you think your characters are products of our times? Or could these just as easily, these stories have been set in 1890 or...
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that some of their particular worries are of our time, but I think that their general complaints and their mistakes and their way of being in the world is, I think, could be considered universal.
Because it is harder these days for some people when they're struggling and it feels like everybody around them is doing okay.
Right, and I think that what happens is now we're saturated to a degree that we're getting a lot of false impressions about how everybody is doing, and that's what we end up measuring ourselves against.
It's interesting that the title of one of the stories is The Republic of Empathy, because most reviewers start off by noting that your characters tend to be less than likable and then suggest that you keep the reader engaged because you have so much empathy for them nonetheless.
Well, I hope that's true. I hope that I'm keeping readers engaged. And I don't sit down to holding these characters at arm's length, sort of mocking them. They're very dear to my heart, and I feel very connected to the things that that they're facing.
The males, but you do seem to have a softer spot in your heart for your female characters.
Maybe, although they have some rough times too.
Didn't you begin as a writer of short stories? Have you been writing them all along while you published the novels?
I began with a collection. That was my first book. And sort of as I was writing maybe my last two novels, I started writing more stories on the side. And then after The Ask, I really devoted myself to them.
Do you see the stories in some ways as being in dialogue with the novels? Because a lot of people have seen connections between some of these stories and your last novel, The Ask.
Yeah, I think that some of the stories were written when I was thinking about similar things, and that came up in my novel. And so I could see a little overlap in concerns and tone with different stories in different books, different novels.
In the Quarterly Conversations review of The Ask, there's this line: "Lipsyte's like a stand-up comedian who has decided to stop being funny and speak the truth, even though what comes out of his mouth still sounds terribly funny." So do you set out with the idea of writing comedically, or is it the only style you know?
Well, I think there's a spectrum of humor in my work, and some of it's a little graver, and some of it is still pretty grim, but uses humor in a more pronounced way. But I don't sit down and plan it, nor do I sit down and say, I'm going to write this satire of America as we are experiencing it in this moment. I start very small and see what grows out of a few sentences, some characters, some situations.
And you don't say to yourself, well, we've gone two paragraphs without a funny line. I better have something here now.
No, that's more like sitcom beats. I don't really think along those terms, but it comes out the way it comes out. And if it seems funny to me, all the better.
In a rave review in the Sunday New York Times book review section, Ben Fountain asks, if these are the fun parts, who needs the angst and wastes of Russian literature? You've been compared to Nathaniel West because of the way he merged satire, angst, and slapstick. Is he one of the influences?
Oh, I love Nathaniel West and read him as a young man. And he had, a big influence on me, not necessarily stylistically, but in worldview, in a way of apprehending things.
But what about some the Dostoevsky of the underground?
Yeah, that too. I think he informs West as well, the underground man.
None of these stories is called The Fun Parts, so why give the collection that title?
Well, I was casting about for a title, and The Fun Parts as a phrase appears in one of the stories, and it seemed to have a few meanings to me, maybe a crude meaning, but also that sense of people reading for the good parts or the fun parts of a book. Back to childhood when people would underline passages for you. But also, I always think of it when I'm teaching and students say, I just have to get through this boring part so the good part can come. But I have to do all this boring stuff so the reader will know what's going on. And just the idea that, well, perhaps we don't need that boring part. It can all be the good part.
Well, in short stories, that's a lot easier than it is in a novel, isn't it? Because a short story is really a pretty compressed way of telling a story.
That's true. It's compressed and you're kind of building towards a moment. But I think a novel can be full of that stuff, full of those moments. And also, while there is certainly information that needs to be imparted, it needs to be imparted in an entertaining way.
So the trick is finding making those boring parts sound interesting.
Right.
That's easier said than done, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes. I mean, that's the whole trick, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, one of the stories, The Republic of Empathy, which I mentioned earlier, was included in the New Yorker science fiction section. It didn't feel like a science fiction story to me. In fact, I wonder if science fiction is something you even think much about.
Well, I didn't write it thinking about science fiction, and the New Yorker initially took the story as a story and then told me they would be including it in the science fiction issue, and it tickled me. I like the idea. I grew up reading a lot of science fiction. Maybe that story has some relation to what people call slipstream fiction, but I'm not even sure what the definition of that is.
Or what Margaret Atwood calls speculative fiction.
Well, speculative fiction is actually, I think, a better term than science fiction.
There is a section in that story, which is broken up into a number of different sections, on drones. Do some of your ideas come from what you are reading in the news?
Well, the whole drone explosion in the news really happened about a year after I wrote the story. Just recently it happened. So I guess I had been following the drone story for a while, and I was even considering at one point a few years ago writing a novel in the voice of a drone, even though they are actually piloted by people in front of a computer. But the idea of this computer soldier, computer pilot, interested me as a narrator, but I never really got a handle on that until I did a little bit in the story.
Well, maybe you're ahead of the curve, because just the other day in the newspapers there was an article about these new smart drones that think for themselves.
Right. That'll be very interesting to see what kind of thoughts they have.
Compared with the novels, is working on a short story, does it require a different rhythm?
Yeah. I start writing, and then the writing sort of tells me whether it's kind of closing down and taking shape and as a story, or it's opening up and might be something longer. But once I've made the decision that it's a story, I think what happens is the rhythm is you finish a draft faster, and then you go through revisions faster. And the main thing for me is to still slow down and even take a break so I can rest and then give it another look when my eyes are fresh.
The title of Sam Lipsight's new collection of short stories is The Fun Parts, and it's no coincidence that there are a lot of fun parts in it. He's my guest right now, and his book has been published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Now, you come from a family of writers. Your father is Robert Lipsight, the New York Times sports writer. Your mother, Marjorie, is a journalist as well, but she has also published a novel.
She published a novel.
She was.
She published a novel in the mid-70s called Hot Type.
So was it only a natural thing that you would become a writer?
I guess it's somewhat like being the son of a coach or an athlete and hanging around in the locker room with people who have this pretty single-minded pursuit. It suddenly doesn't seem bizarre or strange that one would want to become a writer. But then I also...
Well, did your parents discuss it at the family dinner table?
They discussed... they discussed publishing more than writing at the dinner table, or the politics of the New York Times. That was a big topic. But they left me alone and let me sort of make my own way and make my own decisions.
And how long before you decided you want to become a writer? Because you've said that you're glad it took you nearly 40 years to start publishing stories in The New Yorker.
I did say that. But that I was putting in work from my – serious work, I would say, from my mid-teens. I had – periods where I didn't write and did other things, but I got serious again in my mid-20s, and that since then it's been a pretty consistent thing.
A number of writers have talked about writing and plodding along, and then suddenly something clicked, and then from then on it was a lot different for them. Did that happen with you?
I did have an experience with it's the first story of my first collection, and up until then I'd been trying new approaches to writing and hitting walls, and what was coming up felt very kind of mannered and overdone. And then one day I just started writing without thinking about it too much. And it wasn't just that it flowed, because certainly things can flow and still be bad, but it flowed and I sensed its power. I sensed that it was better than the things I had done before. And I had a kind of moment of thinking, oh, this is writing. This is what it actually is to be writing.
Well, you were supporting yourself by doing some online writing. Did that influence you? Because you have to be very direct in that kind of writing.
You do have to be direct. It was interesting. I was working for an online magazine and editing it often. And so I felt my job during the day was to cram as much information in an entertaining way as possible into the columns and reviews that we were running. But then I would go home at night to write the book, and I felt I was trying to push all the information out again to clear space for stories to occur.
You write great dialogue. Are you hearing conversations in your head, or are you just eavesdropping a lot?
I eavesdrop sometimes. I mishear things sometimes. I hear things anew. I was telling somebody I was in a supermarket, and I'd heard this phrase a million times. Somebody rings something up wrong, and you hear someone say, "I need a void," mm-hmm. and suddenly the phrase seemed far more profound than I'd ever imagined.
So something like that get you thinking about doing a story?
Well, that's the kind of thing that I want to then build a story around, but that might be something I just have in my head for the rest of my life. But some things like that, sure.
So I Need a Void, have you been able to incorporate it into anything yet?
I have not used it yet, but anyone is free to now. Yeah.
Well, we've pretty much run out of time, so I can't ask you about where some of these stories come from, like the doulo or the junkie who wants to write stories for kids and decides to write a book about Marvin Hagler as a kid's book, or the daughter of the Holocaust survivor who suddenly is being stalked by an admirer who happens to be a neo-Nazi.
Ex-neo-Nazi.
So yeah. She is part of his working things out for himself?
I would say he is more part of her working out some things.
Sam Lipsight is the author of Venus Drive, the subject Steve, Homeland, The Ask, the latter two of which were New York Times notable books. He won the first annual Believer Book Award, was a 2000. Well, you also won a Guggenheim, lucky you. The latest book is a collection of short stories called The Fun Parts, and it is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.